Millions of Palestinians, including women and children, were killed in the Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip in 11 days of the conflict that began on May 10. Israel's airstrikes also brought widespread devastation to the already impoverished territory.
Palestinians here say the aggression has not undermined their will to stand against the occupation regime. They say despite their suffering, they will remain steadfast and fight for their rights. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
In the limelight.
The pandemic has only exacerbated the pre-existing inequalities in U.S. care system. Executives of for-profit senior homes pocket obscenely large paychecks, even during the COVID crisis. The CEO of Welltower, the U.S. largest owner of nursing homes and other senior housing, made more than $14 million in 2020. Meanwhile, ordinary families struggle to afford care for their loved ones, even as caregivers earn poverty wages. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Rebecca Entroglo, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. is failing to protect care workers. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Between daycare closures, school closures, and nursing homes becoming hotbeds for the deadly virus, the COVID-19 pandemic turned millions of American people into caregivers overnight. These additional caregiving responsibilities are a key factor holding many Americans back from re-entering the workforce. While Republicans try to argue that overly generous unemployment benefits are causing staffing shortages in some pockets of the economy, the real obstacles are the lack of available and affordable child and elder care, combined with the low wages for many of the available jobs. Women are particularly affected by these challenges, since they shoulder a disproportionate share of caregiving duties. Nearly 3 million women left the workforce entirely between March 2020 and February of this year. The pandemic has only exacerbated the pre-existing inequalities in U.S. care system. Executives of for-profit senior homes pocket obscenely large paychecks, even during the COVID crisis. The CEO of Welltower, the U.S. largest owner of nursing homes and other senior housing, made more than $14 million in 2020. Meanwhile, ordinary families struggle to afford care for their loved ones, even as caregivers earn poverty wages. What will it take to build a more equitable and sustainable support system for both family and professional caregivers? You have to really love what you do because your pay doesn't reflect it. The respect doesn't reflect it, and we aren't protected, said Benjamin during a webinar hosted by the 19th, a nonprofit newsroom reporting at the intersection of gender, politics, and policy. So that makes us feel like we aren't essential, and seeing as we are the ones that are supposed to be taking care of people, why is it that we are the least cared about? Benjamin works as a home health aide in Illinois and is a member of the SEIU Healthcare Union. Benjamin, like many of her counterparts, is a black woman. Among all U.S. home care workers, over 90% are women, more than half are women of color, and 31% are immigrants. And despite the fact that the care economy is projected to be one of the fastest growing industries, with an estimated 1.6 million jobs related to adult care alone expected to be added by 2024, home care workers currently earn on average just under $17,000 a year, and one in six live below the poverty line. Home care worker Adara Benjamin speaks on a panel about building a sustainable care economy. A recent study by the City University of New York and the Association of Aging in New York found that low wages are a major factor in the shortage of home care workers. Some 17% of home care positions in the state are currently unfilled. While some American lawmakers disagree with including caregiving investments in an infrastructure package, those who perform this labor day in and day out are as essential to U.S. society and economy as roads and bridges. Benjamin said, "We are all going to get older. We are all going to need a care worker. So understanding and taking opportunity to invest in something that we are all going to need is the biggest step."
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, we are here with you from the moon to the sun. On the show, we are actually celebrating the birth anniversary of a heavenly brother and sister, Sayyidah Ma'asum as-salamu allah alayha, and Imam Rida alayhi salam. And all across the world, the 10 days between the two auspicious birthdays is known as the 10 days of Kirama, and in the middle of these 10 days, we commemorate a very distinguished, very prominent, very special personality, someone that unfortunately, compared to all his virtues and all his merits, is spoken about not enough. He is one of the children of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, the brother of Imam Ridha and Sayyidah Ma'asuma. And he is here in Iran also. He's buried in the city of Shiraz, and his shrine is the sanctuary for many of the hearts of the devotees of the Ahlul Bayt. He is none other than Ahmad bin Musa alayhi salam, known here as Shah Chiragh. Of course, we're here with my special friend and dear sister, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Eid Mubarak.
Eid Mubarak to you too. I'm really happy to be here again with you on another episode of
the
program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
From the moon to the sun. And at this point, all the stars in between. So, Sister Razia, looking back, I think Imam Ridha, Sayyidah Ma'asuma, and Ahmad bin Musa are three of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam's most distinguished children. Imam Musa alayhi salam, Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, had many kids, and I think for clear reasons, he had to have perhaps representatives across the region, and because he was so limited, mm-hmm. he was so restricted from communicating, connecting with his followers. Mm-hmm. And so I think we should take this opportunity to speak about Ahmed bin Musa and be more familiar with him.
There's so much to talk about this noble personality, whether you can talk about him in the city of Medina before migrating to Iran. And also there is so much to say with regards to him, how, you know, he started to embark on his journey to come to Iran. Well, with regards to the personality of Amir Ahmed bin Musa al-Qadim, I can say that he was very well known as a very brave personality. He was very well known because of his chastity and piety, because of his vigilance. For many portions of the night, he would stay awake mm-hmm. until the morning, and he would worship. And some very significant point about him was that he was a very wealthy personality in the city of Medina, and he was at the same time very generous. The other personality that I can say about him was that he wrote transcripts of the Quran with his own hands, and he had like so many, he wanted to spread the noble Quran by writing the because they didn't have like types and like publishing companies. Yeah. So he wrote manuscripts of the Quran himself with his noble hands. And his nobility, his loyalty to his imam, to the imam of his time, is also another very significant trait that we also talked about with regards to Lady Fatimah al-Masuma in our previous programs. But even with regards to Amir Ahmed bin Musa al-Qadim, the same trait is highlighted and is valid. Why do I say this? Because when the news of the martyrdom of Imam Musa al-Qadim spread in the city of Medina, automatically people wanted to know who the next imam, I mean, they wanted to swear allegiance to the next imam of their time. So because of all the noble traits and because of the unique and superb personality of Amir Ahmed bin Musa, many people thought that their next imam will be automatically Amir Ahmed bin Musa. So they rushed to their house, to his house, and they said, we want to show our loyalty to you, we want to swear allegiance to you. And they swore allegiance, they all went to the mosque of the noble prophet, and he went up on top of the pulpit and he started to deliver a very eloquent and beautiful speech. And then he said, okay, everyone, oh people, ya ayyuha an-nas, for whoever you think that I am their next successor of Imam Musa al-Qadim, I myself am one of the followers of my own brother Ali bin Musa al-Ridha. And I will myself pledge allegiance, swear an oath of allegiance with my brother Imam Ali alayhi salam. So he took all of them to the door of Imam Ali bin Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, and they all swore allegiance with him. And there is a very interesting prayer that Imam Ali alayhi salam says with regards to Ahmed bin Musa. He said that, Alhamdulillah, that you have been so loyal, you've been a very sincere person in this world. I pray that inshallah Allah will make your life to be very smooth, and everything in your life will go on as your personality, as your sincere personality really truly is.
MashaAllah. We're going to be back after a short break. Stay tuned. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And today we are commemorating a very prominent Islamic character, the brother of Imam Ridha and Sayyidina Masuma alayhi salam, and the noble son of Imam Musa al-Qadim, His Eminence Ahmed bin Musa, a gem, a pearl, a prince, who is resting in the city of Shiraz in the country of Iran. And we are very blessed and privileged to have the opportunity to talk about his personality here with Sister Razia Shamili. Sister Razia, a very interesting thing that crossed my mind when you were speaking about His Eminence, Ahmed bin Musa alayhi salam, is that, I'm not saying often, but we've heard in history that there were brothers of the Imam that neglected the right of their Imam, and when it really came down to it, they failed the test of loyalty. And then there was this phenomenon called Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, the son of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He really made his father proud to an extent that his name has been the equivalent to loyalty for so many centuries. And then when you told me the story of Ahmed bin Musa alayhi salam, it resonated the personality exactly of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas in my mind, that loyalty, that level of piety.
Yeah.
And then that level of loyalty, it was just so remarkable.
And it's interesting that he had such an outstanding personality and character amongst the people. I mean, he was someone very special and unique, not only in the eyes of people, but also in the eyes of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. He was a special child of the Imam, besides, of course, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, and also Lady Fatima al-Ma'suma. But Imam Ahmed bin Musa was also very, very outstanding, and Imam loved him to the point that Imam Musa, gifted him one of the very good farms that he had to his dear son, Amir Ahmed bin Musa. And whenever they were in a crowd, people looked up to Amir Ahmed. Like when he stood up, they all stood up. When he sat down, they all sat down. So he was like a director, like a leader to people. That's why many people thought that automatically after Imam Musa al-Kadhim, he will be the next successor, and they swore the Pledge of Allegiance. So let's go to the second part of the story, the part that Imam Ali ibn Musa migrates, of course, by the force, by the command of Ma'mun al-Abbasi. He travels to the city of Marv in Iran, and after him, many members of his family also decide to migrate to the country of Iran to have a safer life and to be alongside their imam and leader, you know, to support him up, to be by his side, and to take guidance and leadership from Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha al-Murtada. So there are different narrations with regards to the story of Ahmed bin Musa, of whether he traveled, at the time of Imam Ridha, whether it was after his martyrdom. But the very prominent narration and hadith that we have with regard to Ahmed is that he wanted to be by the side of his brother, just like Lady Fatima al-Masuma. He traveled to Iran, and on the way, because of his very superb personality and nobility of character, many people joined him. Alongside many of the Hashimis, many of the his family members, other people, other Muslim men and women, that they say that by the time that he was near the city of Shiraz, about 15,000 people had joined him on this journey to also accompany him to the city of Marv in Iran. And, of course, automatically the ruler of the time would get very frustrated, frightened. He would feel threatened by such an appeal. And Ma'mun sent some troops, he ordered the ruler of Shiraz, who was a nearby city where he was passing, Ahmed bin Musa was passing up by. And he sent 40,000 troops men to come and stop the way, obstruct the way, prevent him from continuing the journey.
Unfortunately, we have so very little time left, so we can just wrap this up.
There was a clash, there was a war, conflict between the two armies. In the first appeal, the Hashemis and the followers of Ahmad bin Musa did not disperse, but after a rumor which was spread that Ali ibn Musa Ridha has been martyred, many people scattered from amongst Ahmad bin Musa, and they lost, unfortunately, in the war. Ahmad had to escape. He had to travel to the city of Shiraz in disguise, along with his two other brothers, and he remained there for 1 year, and then he was found by the agents of the ruler, and then he was martyred. And then there's a beautiful story of why he's called Shah-e-Chiraq, that
inshallah.
Unfortunately we don't have time.
Yeah, we don't have time for that, but inshallah, perhaps in further episodes,
inshallah,
we'll have a quick look back at it. Thank you so much,
sure,
Sister Razia. Wherever you are, I hope your heart is blessed with the light of the Ahlul Bayt. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Iran's health minister, Saeed Namaki, announced on Monday that the Coviran Barakat coronavirus vaccine have received approval for public inoculations.
A legal commission gave approval to the Barakat vaccine for emergency use. The Barakat complex can now distribute the vaccines it's produced. God willing, the vaccine will be added to the national vaccination program starting next week.
He said that Iran had gone through nearly a year of intensive work to join the club of countries in the world with the capacity to scale up production for coronavirus vaccines. Coviran Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and started to be mass-produced on March 29. It's been developed by Shifa Farmid, a subsidiary of the Iranian economic and industrial conglomerate Sattar. The factory says its production capacity will reach 12 to 15 million doses per month in summer. Iran is among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against the coronavirus, and now four companies are endeavoring to release their products by September and inoculate the whole population.
The ability of Iran to develop its own vaccine is a step forward. It would have been a lot easier, I suspect, had there been no sanctions on some of the chemicals and other things needed to develop the vaccines. So I think we have to go back to these principles. If we are serious, if the United States is serious about moving forward to prevent the spread of this virus and to save lives, then there has to be an open-handed, generous, and honest relationship with Iran, with Cuba, with China and Russia and other makers of vaccines, including India and South Africa, all of which has been impeded by this emphasis on privatization and the maintenance of sanctions.
Iran hopes that domestic initiatives could significantly boost vaccine supplies for a nationwide inoculation program that started last year. The G7 summit in the United Kingdom ended with a pledge to distribute 1 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccine to the developing world, a figure that activists say is a drop in the bucket in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic. In the meantime, some Western nations have been accused of hoarding the vaccines, even though their inoculation programs have lost their momentum. Others are also accusing them of engaging in vaccine diplomacy, taking advantage of vaccine donations to seek diplomatic favors, something that even the Western countries have acknowledged.
There's no doubt there's some of this going about, and we don't support vaccine diplomacy, let alone blackmail. We think that we've got a moral duty, but also a strong vested interest in getting the world vaccinated, because we know no one's safe until we're all safe.
The major pharmaceutical companies are yet to grant a waiver on the intellectual property rights behind the production of their COVID-19 vaccines, a move that would facilitate poorer nations' access to the jabs. Meanwhile, nations like Iran and Cuba have joined forces to develop their vaccines to protect their population against the coronavirus pandemic.
From my point of view, I think it's great that Iran has been able to develop a vaccine working with the Cubans and the Russians and others. And this is an important step. And I think it's one reason why the United States began to say the other day, about 3 weeks ago now, well, maybe we should relax the patents and so on and so forth. But the whole system in the last 18 months reduced the speed and the efficacy of the distribution of the vaccine.
As major vaccine producers keep away the doses from the rest of the world, vaccines built by developing countries can be a beacon of hope for millions of people.
Ngo Dinh Diem, a pro-American, became president of South Vietnam in 1955 and with the assistance of the U.S. began to arrest anyone suspected of being a member of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition. The U.S. then gradually increased its troop deployment to the country, fearing that communism would soon spread across the region. In 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin incident gave the U.S. government an excuse to justify a war on Vietnam. An intruding U.S. destroyer clashed with North Vietnamese Navy torpedo boats in August of that year. In an ensuing sea battle, one U.S. aircraft and three North Vietnamese torpedo boats were damaged. Also, four North Vietnamese soldiers were killed. As a result, the U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. After a bloody and protracted war, a truce was struck in 1973, ending direct U.S. involvement and completing the evacuation of American forces, which had grown to 500,000. The war claimed the lives of 58,000 Americans and 4 million Vietnamese. It impacted 700,000 American veterans, cost the U.S. more than $100 billion, and tarnished the country's image and morale at home. However, the true narrative behind the Vietnam War was revealed after then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara commissioned a secret history based on classified papers, the Pentagon Papers, in 1967. He formed a research team to assemble and analyze Defense Department decision-making dating back to 1945. An analyst on the research, Daniel Ellsberg, eventually disclosed portions of the report to the New York Times, which was published in 1971. The papers revealed that the U.S. had secretly enlarged the scope of its actions in the Vietnam War, with coastal raids on North Vietnam and Marine Corps attacks, none of which were reported in the mainstream media. The Pentagon Papers are an important record of the United States' first defeat in a war. To this day, the United States' failures in the Vietnam War, as well as its atrocities in terms of civilian casualties and the deployment of chemical weapons, have stained America's reputation at home and abroad. After years of battle and endless resources poured into the U.S. military to win the Battle of Vietnam, the result saw the U.S. lose the war and has since seen it lose many more, all from the same common denominator. Daniel Ellsberg has compared the Forever Wars with the Vietnam War. He says both conflicts are characterized by lies and deceptions fed to the American people and the rest of the world about the inflated and false achievements of the wars. America's Forever Wars have lasted for two decades and cost $6.4 trillion, resulting in calls on Washington to reassess its policies, as there are doubts whether the benefits to U.S. security outweigh the costs. The U.S. troops have also conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. The U.S. military has conducted so-called counter-terror activities in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. Moreover, Washington owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. The ongoing war on terror has taken a heavy toll as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and over 335,000 civilians have lost their lives.
Oh, definitely, and they're not gonna learn that lesson as long as the U.S. remains an imperialist country. And the reality is that every war, from Korea to Vietnam, and even if we went back further in history to the wars against the Native Americans, the people are always demonized in the targeted countries. Those are the targets of the war machine. And today we have the same thing going on. Cuba is demonized, Venezuela is demonized, North Korea, Iran.
After spending trillions of dollars and ruining the lives of millions during the forever wars, Washington has failed to win a single war as yet. The Vietnam War and the forever wars share the same characteristics, the lies and deceptions fed to the American people and the rest of the world about the war's exaggerated and false achievements. It seems Washington doesn't want to learn its lesson and stop fighting lost battles. Since 2010, Israel has been linked to at least a dozen of attacks on Iran's nuclear program. These operations were aimed at disrupting Iran's progress in the field of peaceful nuclear technology through acts of sabotage targeting Iran's nuclear facilities and assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Between 2010 and 2012, four Iranian scientists, Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Dariush Rezai Nejad, and Mohsen Ahmadi Roshan, were assassinated, while another scientist named Fereydoun Abbasi was wounded in an attempted murder. Also, in November 2020, another top Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated in a roadside attack. Iran blamed the killing on Israel and condemned it as terrorism. Tehran also slammed world bodies for their silence on the acts of terrorism targeting the Iranian nation and its elite personalities. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv neither confirmed nor denied its involvement in the attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and scientists. However, last week, Israel's Channel 12 aired an eye-opening interview with former Mossad chief Yossi Cohen, who led the spy agency for more than 5 years. Yossi Cohen hinted at Tel Aviv's involvement in two explosions over the last year at Natanz nuclear facility, as well as the assassination of a prominent nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He also shamelessly threatened Iranian scientists involved in the country's nuclear program with death. That's while Israel has always pursued a policy of deliberate ambiguity over its nuclear capabilities, as well as the issue of targeted killings and airstrikes. Iran's mission to the United Nations slammed Israeli lawlessness, saying that Cohen's comments reflect Tel Aviv's long-standing strategy of criminal sabotage against Tehran. Cohen's interview is aired as talks to revive Iran's nuclear deal are about to resume amid hints of progress. The Israeli regime has been the nuclear deal's strongest opponent, although the United Nations, the European Union, and others have hailed it as a diplomatic success. Iran has repeatedly complained about Israel's attacks, with Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, warning as recently as Thursday that the incidents not only will be responded to decisively, but also certainly leave no option for Iran but to reconsider its transparency measures and cooperation policy. Gharibabadi also slammed IAEA's silence in the face of terrorist attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of scientists. Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of the weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program and assassinated several Iranian nuclear scientists in recent years. However, Iran has rejected all these accusations, as it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. and it has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. That's why the Israeli regime itself has, under constant U.S. protection, avoided joining the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and is now in possession of hundreds of nuclear warheads and other non-conventional weaponry.
Israel is saying that it claims a right to commit any act of murder or sabotage against Iran that it wishes. But what Israel doesn't realize, and what Israel's American backers don't realize, is that that these kinds of actions virtually force Iran or other such countries to take equivalent measures against Israel and the U.S. So they're opening up a Pandora's box by opening the international scene to all kinds of acts of murder, sabotage, revenge, etc. And every country will claim the right to do so, and they'll cite Israel as an example. So, as I said, Israel is playing with fire here and is going to get burned because equivalent measures will be taken against it.
The revelation of outgoing Israel's spy agency that Israel was behind recent attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and its top scientists shows that it has no respect for the law. That's why Israel has followed a deliberate policy of ambiguity for years. It seems favoritism towards Israel by the International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as Washington's invariable support for the regime, has given it the green light to break international law. Isn't it high time for the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes?
When the novel coronavirus began to spread around the globe in early 2020, many were pinning their hopes on herd immunity as a means to end the pandemic. A slow process in which a majority of the population becomes immune to the disease, making the transmission harder. But scientists began their studies on the contagion from early on to understand the virus and produce a vaccine. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine became the first to obtain the World Health Organization's approval for emergency use, offering the world a glimmer of hope in the fight against the deadly respiratory disease. Months later, however, the world is still struggling with the pandemic and its impact on the lives of its 8 billion inhabitants. While new cases and deaths have sharply fallen in richer nations, poorer countries, including those in Africa, are witnessing soaring infections and fatalities. Many observers, including the WHO, attribute that to vaccine inequity.
6 months since the first vaccines were administered, high-income countries have administered almost 44% of the world's doses. Low-income countries have administered just 0.4%. The most frustrating thing about this statistic is that it hasn't changed in months. Inequitable vaccination is a threat to all nations, not just those with the fewest vaccines.
Well, I think that it's never too late if you're talking about saving lives around the world, but I believe that it's absolutely true that we should have approached this pandemic as a global problem from the very beginning. If all of the countries had teamed together and distributed the vaccines across the globe early on, I think we would have seen much, much less death and devastation due to this pandemic. So, yes, it's wonderful that some countries are stepping up now and offering doses of the vaccine, but absolutely this should have been done, 12, 13, 15 months ago.
Human rights groups and charities are calling on the world's richest nations to do more to help bring the pandemic to an end. Ahead of his visit to the United Kingdom to attend the G7 summit, U.S. President Joe Biden unveiled America's plan to help poorer nations fight the COVID-19 outbreak.
The United States will purchase 500 million doses of Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine to donate to nearly 100 nations that are in dire need in the fight against this pandemic.
Other G7 nations have also pledged to chip in to meet the group's 1 billion dose target. In the meantime, health and anti-poverty campaigners say while the G7's pledge is a step in the right direction, it falls short of the number of doses needed to win the battle against the pandemic. Charity organization Oxfam said, to end the COVID crisis, the world needs 11 billion doses of vaccines. It also called on the G7 to support a push for a waiver on the intellectual property rights behind the vaccines, a move that would give other nations better access to the much-needed jabs.
I think that the amount of doses being offered are absolutely a drop in the bucket, and we've seen certainly here in the United States that the country was very, very cautious about releasing doses, hoarding doses, really, of the vaccine for a very long time, partly with a notion of protecting the local residents first before sharing vaccines with the rest of the world. And I do think this is a very short-sighted approach, because the vaccine does not know boundaries. The vaccine does not know national borders. And so, as we've seen with the way the pandemic spread, you have to vaccinate the entire world in order to protect everyone in the world. So the idea of reserving doses just for your own population, I think, is very, very short-sighted on the part of all of these countries.
According to Johns Hopkins University, over 2.2 billion doses have been administered worldwide as of June 12, 2020. At this rate, several countries are expected to fall short of the WHO's target of inoculating 10% of their population against the infectious disease by September.
The Light.
Elders in an Indonesian town are rewarded with live chickens if they get vaccinated for COVID-19. Officials in a town of Sipanas launched the program after the vaccination campaign faced a low turnout from the public. Many have been reluctant to receive a jab over various reasons. Some say they were afraid that they would die if they get vaccinated. Now it seems that the rewards they take have worked well, and more people are willing to get a shot. Officials in the Indonesian town say they go door to door to give the elderly jabs and chickens to show their appreciation. Technology has come in handy to rescue animals in disaster zones. American cinematographer Douglas Throne has used a high-tech infrared drone to save animals from fire or storm or even stuck in trees. The drone he uses has a large thermal camera, a spotlight, and zoom lens. The good point is that the aerial vehicle does not make too much noise. Therefore, it does not scare away animals.
So what I do is I fly infrared drones primarily at night over disaster areas after a hurricane or a fire hits, and I look for people's pets, whether it be cats or dogs, and I also look for injured wildlife, and then either I or rescue crews will go in and rescue the animals after I spot the animals after these natural disasters.
Throne has so far rescued hundreds of stranded animals in various places in the U.S. and Australia. Emergency services have allowed him to participate in rescue efforts after making sure that the drone works well to achieve its goal.
Children have their own ways of remembering the dead. In Gaza, Palestinian kids fly kites in memory of their peers who lost their lives in the recent Israeli onslaught. Dozens of kids participated in the event, holding kites bearing the pictures of 66 little victims. According to the organizers, the goal was to send a message to people around the world that Palestinian kids have the right to live a free and happy life. The children said their dream is to fly in the sky without any restrictions or wars. herd of wild Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
Chinese grandma has given a dazzling display of her masterly kung fu performance at a martial arts competition. The 98-year-old woman and her son took the stage as a curtain raiser to the event. The duo put on a kung fu show before a large crowd of spectators who were impressed by her skillful gestures. She was invited to the competition to act as a judge.
I started practicing martial arts when I was only five. I would box every day, learning movements like chopping, pushing palm, and thrusting palm. Though I am old now, my strength hasn't gone.
Zhang says she's inherited her family's martial arts. She's rumored to have a sense of justice from a very young age and try to help others, which earned her quite a reputation where she lives. Traditional martial arts have been passed down in the Zhongqing village located in Zhejiang province for 500 years. Go to Italy, where Mount Etna has put on an eye-catching show with its spectacular eruptions. Red-hot lava fountains and plumes of smoke spewed up into the sky. The main eruption was located at the southeastern crater of the volcano. Mount Etna is Europe's tallest active volcano. It's located above the Sicilian town of Catania. It often erupts but rarely causes damage. However, nearby residents have to deal with ash showers. Geological studies show that Mount Etna has been active for more than 2 million years now. Egypt has opened its first archaeological replica factory in an attempt to promote its culture worldwide. The factory was inaugurated in response to people's demand for having detailed copies of ancient treasures. So far, over 6,400 high-quality replicas of ancient Egyptian artifacts have been produced. More than 150 artists work to make the goods out of stone, wood, and even gold.
The materials with which these are made are high quality. The highest and most elegant materials are being used to make these samples, and the materials are very close to those used to make the original artifacts.
The models have certificates showing that they are identical copies of the original artifacts. Each replica also has a barcode that provides extra information about the item. The factory is located in Kayuba, about 35 kilometers northeast of the capital, Cairo.
Now, a lot of people don't like rats and find them disgusting most of the time. However, the rodents are doing life-saving work in Cambodia. Now, the Southeast Asian nation has deployed a new squad of African giant pouched rats to sniff out old landmines. The new recruits have shown an exceptional ability at their task, with their handlers claiming 100% accuracy. There are now nearly 50 demining rats working in the field in Cambodia. The country started using the animal services in 2016, and they have helped detect and clear hundreds of landmines since. Last year, an especially heroic rat called Magawa attracted global fame after receiving a gold medal for his work. The hero rat, who is now retired, detected over 71 landmines.
A muralist from Greece is blending mythology with graffiti and street art to depict how COVID-19 has impacted lives around the globe. Ficus Antonius has painted the walls of many cities around the globe. He is now in the Cypriot capital, Nicosia, to continue his work. His latest artwork depicts Americus, a Cypriot mythical figure who was punished by the gods and turned into a plant. The Greek artist believes this theme is similar to the situation people around the globe have experienced since the pandemic began. He explains many people have grown roots because they're staying in one place for so long. Two British artists have brought a combination of fun art and environmental concerns to the sidelines of the G7 summit. They have created a modern-day version of famous sculpture carved into America's Mount Rushmore. This time, it's called Mount Recyclemore. Joe Rush and Alex Rakic have made a sculpture of G7 leaders with electronic waste. They say their major goal is to raise awareness about the amount of unrecycled tech and gadgets, the damage they cause to the environment, and the ways to combat the issue internationally.
Well, what I'd like them to do, the leaders of the G7 conference, is I'd like them all to talk to each other and work out a plan that isn't just shifting the problem from one country to another, you know, but actually is a plan that we all work on together, which is how to deal with this waste and how to stop producing so much waste and how to recycle things. And all these issues have got to be dealt with globally. They can't be dealt with nationally because that's where the problem is. So we need them all to get together, like we've put them together here, and deal with the problem.
The United Nations says 53 million tons of electronic waste are generated annually all over the world. It estimates that the amount of the waste will double in less than 30 years. If that happens, electronic waste would become the fastest growing waste stream in the world. Advanced robots are increasingly helping humans in a variety of innovative ways. Now, they have found a place in the healthcare system and will help nurses and doctors stay safe during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I can do all kinds of things for elderly people. I can visit with people and brighten their day with social stimulation, entertain and help guide exercise, but also can do talk therapy, take bio readings and help healthcare providers assess their health and deliver treatments.
Grace, which is the newest humanoid robot to join the healthcare fleet. This intelligent machine can take temperatures and record other vital signs of patients. It has been designed in a way to also interact with the elderly and those isolated by the pandemic. Grace is a new prototype of celebrity humanoid robot, Sophia, created by a robotic team in Hong Kong.
So we designed Grace to look professional in a healthcare setting. So that would mean so that she would resemble the sort of human-like appearance of healthcare staff. And so then this would facilitate more natural interactions. A human-like appearance facilitates trust and facilitates a natural engagement because we're wired for human face-to-face interactions. That's just the way human beings are.
Hansen, a while standing between Sophia and Grace, also said that both robots could speak different languages. He said Grace's creation was aimed at relieving the burden of frontline hospital staff dealing with COVID-19 patients. The company is planning a mass production of Grace and offers them to the market by August. The cost of making this robot is similar to a luxury car, but the cost is likely to decrease once the company begins manufacturing it in its thousands.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
tiny worm has wriggled back to life after lying frozen for 24,000 years in the permafrost land of northern Siberia. The organism was recovered from soil samples taken from 3.5 meters below the ground in Russia's Yakutia region. It's a multicellular organism that can withstand extreme cold. This ancient worm has broken the record for the longest living abedloid rotifer worm. Previous research suggests that it could survive for a decade when frozen. Earlier, scientists also discovered 30,000-year-old microscopic worms from northern Siberia. Australian scientists have discovered one of the world's largest ever dinosaur species in the Erromanga area in outback Queensland. Research shows the plant-eating sauropod lived between 92 million and 96 million years ago when Australia was attached to Antarctica. Paleontologists estimated the dinosaur was as long as a basketball court and as tall as a two-story building. That makes it the largest dinosaur ever found in Australia and one of the top five largest ones in the world. Bones of the dinosaur were first uncovered more than a decade ago by cattle farmers. Iranian capital Tehran has hosted a festival of cake sculptors. The event showcases delicious sweets that are carved into eye-catching sculptures. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's not a piece of cake to bake a sculpture, but pastry chefs here have made it. In the fourth festival of cake sculptures in Iran, sugarcraft artists from across the country have come under one roof in Tehran to cast their spell on these sweets and carve a wide range of fascinating 3D figures out of them. From this tasty coronavirus to this beautiful angel that is picking up the only eatable trash in the world.
Here you can see this angel, which represents the innocent heart of labor children, collecting pieces of trash that contain some of the simplest dreams of a labor child, such as quality food, books, and toys.
My cake is made based on what we call installation art. I have put together iconic structures and monuments of Iran, but when you take a look at them from a special angle, you can see Iran's map.
Some of the cake sculptures here have really pushed the envelope of the art of sculpting, like this bust that shows the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, surrounded with a heavenly garden that's decorated with intricate and mind-boggling details. It took its creator almost a month to finish it.
In the middle, I have put the bust of Rumi, who we refer to as Maulana in Iran. He's holding his most significant verse work, Masnavi Manavi. The garden I created around him and the birds here all are inspired by his poems.
Organizers say they hold the festival every year to modernize the confectionery industry and combine it with fine arts to make it more appealing to the public.
500 works are showcased here in four sections. Bust cakes, wedding cakes, cookie cakes, which are made using royal icing, and the fourth section is cream cakes. The major goal is to scout for talents who can revolutionize the confectionery industry.
Some of the participants in the festival are pastry chefs who try to make their cakes look better, and others are actually pro sculptors who want to bake a figure instead of carving it. Perhaps it's easy to tell who is who by taking a glimpse at their cakes. But sweets will win the competition. They're both delicious and delicate.
It takes ultimate care and a knack for both bakery and artistry to be able to transform sweets into statues. In fact, they're both so spectacular and yummy that make you want to have the cake and eat it too. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran's Constitutional Council says all necessary steps have been taken to